Okay, it's September 7, 2008. We're fortunate to have David E. Worster on the line again. We're continuing our review of Bob Carr's book, God Men, Con Men. But there is a topic around the phrase or word gatekeeper that David would like to address.
Yeah, I was asking about the gatekeepers, and the principle is that in the Kabbalah, there are four worlds, and each world has 10 sephira and 22 paths. The basic sephira is Malkuth, and then the top one is the crown. Those who are interested can find this many places. But the principle of the gatekeeper is that if one is meditating on the first world, in order to be able to move to one of the sephira, one meditates along each of the possible paths that are connected to Malkuth. And if one of them starts to light up, that means that the other end in the sephira is a gatekeeper that is opening the door for you. If you try to move to these things without permission, then you are cosmically thrown into the klipoth, which is to the dark side. So one never moves along a path toward a sephira unless it lights up and the gatekeeper opens the door for you to enter. And then from there, then you do the same thing in the sense of watching for any path. Now, we've been using a phrase lately, when the way is made clear. So you can see the significance that if you're in this level of operation, you had better see to it that the way is made clear. So it's great in life to use that as a motto for virtually everything, and then you won't get into trouble with a lot of voracity of your mind, which is just doing this and doing that. And just don't do it unless the way is made clear, and then you'll keep the vibes very, very high. Now, does that answer you, Scott?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Dave.
All right. Okay.
Scott, now you have some other questions that you were in limbo with. You want to go into them?
Oh, no, I don't want to go into that right now. It would be a big distraction, and we're doing Carr.
Okay. Right. Now, Dave, when Bob Carr went down to see Krishnamurti in 1960, a side issue, he only remembers Dave Millett there, not the rest of the Millets. Were the rest of the Millets there?
I think they were, because it was right after that they decided to buy a house in Ojai, and they moved down there. So I think they probably were.
But David caused a scene down there. Can you go into
Well, I know the thing that people were told, that as Krishnamurti left the stage, which was just he would follow along a path to leave, and they were asked not to interrupt him, not to interfere, just to let him go. But just as he left in a triangulation, David Millett moved in the direction which got him just ahead of Krishnamurti in the path, and that meeting occurred. I don't know how much of a meeting it was, because nobody knows what was said. David Millett, I don't think he even remembers, but there was a moment. But it was enough of a moment that he took it as a signal that got him to move the whole family down to Ojai. And then the story goes on from that in a different direction.
Right, but David was about 16 then?
In 1960, no. Let's see. When I first came to the center in about 50 1956-57. He was 15 or 16 then.
So he was born in 41-42, so then he would have been 19.
Something like that, but, you know.
Okay. Anyways, yeah. It was significant to the family that he, whatever Krishnamurti said to David, the rest of them took it as a signal to move closer to Krishnamurti.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure Millet is the one who said, you know, for the, usually he had to do what the family did, but I think what he did is convince them very definitely. And
so was that in Ojai Valley where they bought the place?
Yeah, I think it was in the town.
Okay, and they still have it?
Oh, no. It wasn't long before they sold and moved to Santa Barbara because there was nothing for them to do there. And then they got there, and David started college, and he was amongst a bunch of rich people, and they were doing things, that, and he couldn't do it, and so he got very bitter. That's the first time I heard of him getting bitter. And then after that, they moved back up to the U District in Seattle.
University District.
Yeah.
Okay. For those listening, I've made contact. Yes, the last talk, in the middle of our talk and a couple weeks ago, I got an email from the friend of Bob Carr who posted his cell phone number. So I called Bob Carr. We had a great talk for an hour or so. And then subsequently, I've had four Skype sessions with him, at least an hour each. Last night's was an hour and a half, I think. So he's very interested in what we're doing, and he hopes to be interviewed like we're doing Dave, and he would reveal new things that he didn't put in his book, God, Men, Con Men. But I mentioned the section on page 87 where he says, we had lunch, this is at the Ojai Valley, we had lunch with about 20 people that David knew, who were also interested in Krishnamurti. One was a wealthy person who had written a book called E-Therapy, and he picked up the bill for lunch. I said, well, that's Bo Kisselman, and I'm thinking,
yes.
Bob Carr can't remember the name, but I asked Bob Carr about that, and he certainly remembered the name. If for some reason he didn't put it in, maybe he was covering it up, I don't know. But the point was that he had actually gone to Pyramid Lake at one point, he and Connie.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Now, that's fabulous, because if they had gone there to Pyramid Lake and the date that they went, it may relate to a lot of things. I don't think they went very early because a lot of the happenings happened around 1950, but I think...
No, it was later. I'm not sure.
Oh, I know it was later, but I just...
I don't know if it was before 1960 or not. He'll clarify that, but in my memory of what he said, you know, it was back then, way back then. So, okay, and so he knew Betsy is her name? Betsy?
Yes.
Yeah. So I don't think he... I told him the story about how you said that Bo Kisselman was not a guy to hate anybody, but you were surprised to hear he hated one man, and that turned out to be L. Ron Hubbard. I don't think Bob Carr knew that story. So that was...
Well, it's Betsy that told me. I was astounded myself.
Right. Have we mentioned this on the tape so far about... Yeah, we talked about Pyramid Lake in the last session. Okay.
Now, a little, yeah.
Right. Now, the interesting thing is the next paragraph, it says, when we returned to Seattle, I found that we had a small problem with Eugene, and we talked about Eugene was playing around with some other people, and then he left. Eugene, you know who I mean, Eugene.
I forgot his last name at the moment.
It's in the book here in an earlier
page. Yeah. I remember I didn't have to do very much with him. I had just had to observe. I saw how Bob and Connie kind of related to him, and I was alert.
Eugene,
fairly quickly noticing his meditative sessions with a number of women that were going on, that there was something happening, and then I find he's got a wife, and then they're having problems, and I don't know what happened, but it wasn't very long after that he left, so that's probably what he's referring to here.
Yeah, Eugene Davis.
Yeah, Davis, right.
Right, but he doesn't talk about what you had to do back at the center when he was down, when Bob Carr was down in California with Christian Murray. Go into that character.
No, he left it off all the way. He didn't even say anything about the,
What was his name, that person who came?
Premanand.
Oh, yeah, Premanand. We've talked about
that. Or it might be Premananda, but I think it was Premanand. Yeah.
And so what happened between you and him while Bob was gone?
Well, he came and he talked and had quite a few nice meetings, and he and I went up into the mountains and to Snoqualmie Falls, and then we had a five-hour meditation, eye-to-eye, unblinking for 5 hours, and so after 5 hours, he nodded his head, and so, and he was a Scorpio, and I was Gemini, and it was like, and then he wanted me to travel around the world with him, and I thought about it, but then I thought, oh, I've got things to do here, I'm not going to do that, but he went from our place down to David Shree's place in Portland right after that.
And then you lost touch with him?
Yeah, I heard a story that I never really had verified, that he had supposedly died in some kind of a crash, but I don't know what. But I thought, boy, that, I don't know.
When you were up in the staring at each other, did you have sex with him? Was he a,
no.
No, there's no sexual
issue. No, but there was a potential for that, we knew. But it was the closest thing to tantric sex that I'd ever had in terms of a meditation with someone like that. In other words, the milliseconds of transition from mind to mind was so reduced that it was like mind to mind that ordinarily only could possibly occur in Tantra, where the meter matches and the flow of both nervous systems is simultaneousness. That's what it's all about. Simultaneousness is all about. People talk about it all the time. They don't even know what they're talking about.
Well, that's because the electric environment is simultaneous, so they're just picking up the technological effect.
Yeah, but it's still milliseconds. You see, if you're rubbing each other, that is contact. There's no millisecond different, you know. You understand?
There's no different?
There's no break at all. But if you're close and communicating between the time the energy leaves you and is received by them, there is a millisecond. So you're not really totally relating together in present time.
That's in normal sex.
Or even in conversation.
Okay, good, good. Now you're saying in tantric sex it's immediate.
It's total, and I mean it's the only total simultaneousness there is. The others are all millisecond
delays.
Yeah, break. So therefore, they're not truly on the level of total communication. You know, it's good, but
well, is total communication, does one's consciousness get obliterated?
The whole point of Tantra is to move, take the senses, to use the senses to move to God consciousness, you see. That's it. And then the Puritans came along and said, no. So that made it so that all, there's about 40 different, well, I don't know, maybe I'm pushing it, but about 40 different yogas that are actually segments of the Tantra. But you see, since they're separated, they don't link into the sexual, shall we say.
Yeah.
And so they're the, all these different yoga processes are substitutes that were allowed, that were like bootlegged around Puritanism toward the same thing, but just taking years and years and years that could have taken maybe a few hours.
Okay, but is when one is having near God consciousness, is your self-consciousness obliterated?
Oh, I see what you mean. There is, I think it's obliterated before you even get there. In other words, you've removed your, you can do that anytime, but the final process, if it's tantric, is more complete. The obliteration of self-consciousness is not that difficult, even if someone doesn't do yoga, you know. It's a matter of surrender. The Subud does the surrender to God, and that's the self-consciousness leaves, and leaves a space for the God conscious to operate within the system.
The latter hand.
Yes.
Yeah.
The opening, and then the latter hands.
Yes, we didn't, in talking about the closing of the center and how the Subud organization took it over, I don't think I got a story or two from you about your interaction with the Subud people. You went to a...
Oh, you want to take a side trip on that?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I was... there were a number of people who went to Canada to be opened. And then after that, there was some from Canada that came down to the center. And they actually used my apartment in the basement for a Ladihan where I was opened. And this was, I think, in 1960. In other words, it was before they had gone to California for Krishnamurti. So sometime in 1960, let me see. I think it was fairly early in 1960 because I think I moved out of that apartment before too long. So after that, we had a number of Subud members that right in the center, and so they started doing Ladihans at the center, and then when they went to California and came back, then the decision was made to close the Center of Integration, and I think he tells it as that they related to the Subud people and they turned it over to them. I think that part is fairly clear. Now, at a later point in my life, there was a convention, a world convention for Subud in Vancouver. And it happened to be at a hotel out from town that was near the Gurleys. I forgot the name, the Gurleys. Well, Bob can straighten that out because we were all deep friends. And anyway, Millett and I arrived at the hotel without a reservation, late at night. It might have even been 1 or 2 in the morning. And they had no rooms at the inn, but they had an adjunct annex where somebody had checked out, and so they said, if we did, it was a suite. If we didn't use the bedroom, but just used the pull-out beds in the living room, then we would get it at a very reduced rate for that night. Okay, that's what we did and set up, and I slept there, and I thought I had the strangest night I'd had in a long time. When I got up the next day, it turns out Bapak's suite was right next to us, and his head was on the other side of the wall of mine, and he looked at me, and he shook his finger, and didn't say much. He says, "You're over there." I says, "Yeah."
Well, he's the leader of it.
He was the one who had the experience, which you can look into. Subu then tells about his original experience. Okay. Then that night he had a meeting. They had a talk, and then after the talk, there was a Ladihan. First there was a Ladihan in a big room, and in the middle of the Ladihan, I felt a certain free flow that was extraordinary, and I said, "Well, it's probably because Bapak's here." And then it got stronger, and I opened my eyes, and here he was opposite me doing a mirror image of my moves, and kind of nodded his head, and then wandered on, and I kept doing it. After that, they had a meeting in the hall, and here's Bapak setting up, not behind, but kind of on the side, but looking out at the audience. And I'm sitting there, and they are having a demonstration of Tai Chi. So the guy comes up and starts to do the Tai Chi. And I'm looking, because these are all the same moves that I was moving up in the Ladihan. And Bapak's looking over at me and nodded his head. Which, to me, on a very high level, means that I apparently in a Ladihan was capable of discovering the nature of Tai Chi on my own before ever hearing about it. Mm. And then having somebody come along and just checking me out on that level and nodding, and then later acquiescing that, yeah, this is what it is. So there's more to that over a long period of time, but that's enough for now.
Okay, so now we're just filling a bit of the ending of the center. We've already, in the previous tape, a couple weeks ago, got to San Francisco. So now we're in the house, Bob and Connie's house, or your place. I'm not sure whose, and we're out.
In Oakland, you mean?
Yes, I guess. Is it Grace?
It's Bob Filmon.
Right. Bob Filmon, right, yeah.
Yes.
So, Alan, talk about Alan Watts entering that scene.
All right, to make it pretty continuous. Anyway, my girlfriend, we almost were engaged, maybe we were engaged, but shall we say almost, Mildred Grace Ponch, which I think her later name was Ripple or something.
Yeah, and she told different people she was Grace and other people she was Mildred.
But they were, Mildred Grace Ponch was her full name.
Right, and Bob...
We called her Millie most of the time.
Right, and Bob describes, he says, "One day I got a call from David Wooster, Wooster, an ex..."
Now, shall we spell my name properly at this point?
Yes, it's
Wooster, like Worcester, Massachusetts, or Worcestershire sauce.
Right, it's like Wooster, it's like who?
It's how it sounds.
Who?
He took the phonetic sound and adjusted it.
Yeah, but it has who. He's not sure who you are. You're a Wooster. You play with the being of your...
Yeah, it was like I think, a Connie trip, you know. It's like Connie also called me the Trip Master. I think they both did. But anyway, that came up not only during the acid sessions, but years later, where we went into something, and they introduced... Oh, it was to the Pink Floyd when I met them, when I came in. I didn't know who they were, but he says, "Here comes the Trip Master." You know.
So the Hooster, he made me more than just mispronunciating it.
Yeah.
Okay, one day I got a call from David Hooster, an ex-member of the center. He also had moved to San Francisco not long after we had left. David called to say that he had met a rather strange girl who knew Ellen Watts. Her names were Grace and Mildred. She had two names that she used, each with different people. David told her about me, meaning Bob Carr, and my interest in Krishnamurti, and she said that she would like to meet both Connie and I. Now, let's go into a bit of that that leads into Watts.
All right, so first, she and I go over to meet Bob and Connie and Philman and I believe there were some other people there, but anyway, we were all having a wonderful time, and, you know, no acid or anything like that, just a little wine and good music and joyous living. And so at one point, Mildred's over in the corner of the living room, sitting down in a kind of a yogic posture, and crying. Softly crying, and Bob sees her, and he goes over and tries to help her. Is there anything I can do? She says, well, I don't know. She says, what happened is that Alan Watts told me that my problem is that I didn't celebrate life. And she says, now I know what he means. And she says, you've got to meet him. And they said, well, we'd like to. We tried many times to get him to come up to the center to get involved, and he wouldn't do it. He said he had more important things to do scholastically, because he was making his scholastic mark, and didn't want that interfered with anything else. And so anyway, Mildred and I in San Francisco were picked up by Alan Watts, driving from the ferry. No, wait a minute. I'm placing him on the ferry, and I'm not sure whether he was there yet, because there was a woman in Subud who had a house in Pacific Heights, which is a bunch of mansions, and Alan Watts had the first floor and had it for years, and even had a woman on the East Coast that switched back and forth. She'd come and teach in his place, he'd go to New York and teach in her space. So they didn't have to pay rent for space. And her name was Charlotte Selvers, by the way. And anyway, it's quite possible that, at any rate, they came in this Volkswagen bus and picked Mildred and I up, and we went over to
Bob Filmon's
in Oakland. And actually, we had an interesting evening of dinner and et cetera, and that's when John Noyes, you know, who had been the president of Center of Integration before me, John and Vernetta were on a trip which was going to eventually send John in an airplane up over the South Pacific to observe eclipse for NASA. He was now the astrophysicist for NASA and was like about the fourth or fifth from the top echelon. In other words, the NASA positionings, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, was, I think he was number 5 out of all, you know, if you want to have status.
Right.
So that came out of the LSD sessions. That's also, John, when he was in his first LSD session, he was holding a lemon seed. And I think it was Connie that went over to him at one point and said, "Oh, Jack, what are you doing with the lemon seed?" He says, "Well, I'm a physicist, and with all that I know about physics, it's nothing compared to this, because this gives life." And so he was looking into that in his session very deeply. Anyway.
So he was there at the dinner. He's there at the dinner with Alan Watts.
And also another very interesting person was Tony LaVey, later known as Anton LaVey, who was just, to us, just like a nice little guy.
Was he gay? Known to be gay or anything?
I'm not too sure about him on that.
Why was he there? Who knew him?
Oh, they'd seen him Bob loved everything having to do with magic and the circus and freaks and Biff and, you know, the chimpanzee.
We're talking about Bob Filmon.
No, I'm talking about Bob. Well, of course, Filmon might have been a connector to that, too, because this guy, I mean, I was thinking of Bob Carr, but
right.
Filmon was the same. And so Filmon had this radio show called Mr. Bob.
Wasn't it a TV show?
A TV show, and it came on about 5 o'clock in the evening. And he had he's a ventriloquist, and so he had this a ventriloquist trip with his dummy, and then they'd have the Three Stooges. They'd have about 3 segments of the Three Stooges during the show. Well, I later found out that everybody in town who was getting high on marijuana or whatever, because this was in 1960, I don't know how many there were, but apparently all of them that were rushing home from work in order to catch that show for kids, Mr. Bob. So he became famous. And he'd go where he expected to. He'd fly in by helicopter to a mall, and he would be not greeted by kids as much as adults. Anyway, it was possible that he had the connection with Anton LaVey. Anton LaVey had a calliope, one of these big circus wagon things with a calliope on it that he loved to play in parades. You know, almost every parade they had, he'd come down there with playing on his calliope.
Before he was Anton LaVey, the founder of the church.
Well, he was. His name was Anton LaVey, but everybody called him Tony LaVey at that time. And he played in a bar in West San Francisco near Golden Gate Park that was called The Lost Weekend, and they had a pipe organ, and he played the pipe organ. And when we went there, he opened up the pipe closet, you know, and we were surrounded by pipes while he played. And he played Dance Macabre. Which, incidentally, was so much of a problem. They banned it in Brazil because people were committing suicide after Anyway, he's there. And so after a while...
David, I want to interrupt here. We have some interesting synchronicity 50 years later. These interviews we're doing will be on my website, Dobbstown.com, and I'm Bob Dobbs, and of course my wife is Connie. We have Bob and Connie, and we're talking.
Oh, that's
about
a different Connie. Yeah,
and we're talking about Bob and Connie
Conrad.
Bob and Conrad, but known as Bob and Connie, and they are doing this scene with at Mr. Bob's home. We somehow have come full circle here.
Yes. Bobbing along.
Yes. At least five.
There's a song by that, you know.
Yes. And so we're going to bring Bob Carr and you together at some point, and that's going to be pretty neat. So now, though, I want
to... But all right, taking it back to Philman's, yeah, and with all these people here, at one point, I think it was Bob and Connie and Philman, and I was standing nearby, and I think noise was not very far away, when one of them said, "Why don't we have a session?" Of course, Alan Watts and Mildred and Alan Watts' girlfriend, although he married her later, was Mary Jane.
Anyway,
one of somebody in that group said, "Why don't we have a session?" And they then started to talk about it to everybody and propose it. And Watts, of course, was very interested. And
had never had LSD before.
No, he said, "I've got something that I want you to check when I brought with me." And that was that book on...
Joyous Cosmology.
Yes. Yeah, anyway, everybody agreed that they would do it. But then Bob started. He says, oh, my God. He says, "All I have to do is think about taking it, and I start to get a body rush, and I have to go pee." And so here was this line of people trying to go to the bathroom after just talking about it.
And you're talking Bob Carr, not Bob Filman there.
That was Bob Carr is the one who said that. But anyway, after that, then we took it.
Did you take a pee?
Oh, sure, everybody did. It was like once the see, there's a phenomena of, at a certain point, if somebody's rushing and their juices are working, it telegraphs. It's like ESP
like
on that
yawning
level.
Yeah, like yawning.
Well, at least. So we had the session.
Did he show you the pictures on the session?
Yes. We all had a glorious time, and of course we were also seeing the mandalas in the session. You know, the fractals, etc.
Yeah.
And this was just verifying it, magnifying it.
His pictures, yes.
Yeah, but the pictures themselves were like a reflection of what we were in, you see.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And let's see, that's when Watts also, there was a Congo drum there, and he started to play that, and he just went out of our tree together. we all took the ride. I remember at one point I was laying on the floor, and it's like I had my eyes closed, and he was playing this, and I opened up my eyes, and I was surrounded by very tall black men in garb, and I remember saying, "And we think they're savages." And anyway, after that...
But you're saying he was playing wild? What was the...
Yeah, he was really doing it. He was discovering, and he was doing it. And we were all feeding the energy on it, too. So then it was after that that he made that album, This Is It.
Yes, and we talked a bit about that in a previous session. I went to the website and looked at it.
Yes, okay.
What happens between you and Alan after that?
Well, many things over a period of time. Now, this was 1960.
Yeah.
And, of course, I think I saw him briefly, once or twice, at that house on Pacific Palisades that this woman owned. I would visit her, and I'd see him. Maybe he was busy, but I'd have interchange with him. Later he moved to the ferry, but I can't remember when I first went out there. But I think it wasn't before long, because I think the first time I went there, I went with Bob and Connie and Mildred. And I remember as Watts was lecturing about the process of knowing when to let go. He says, like, if you're riding a horse, you're in control. But there are times of extreme danger when it's best to just let the horse take the lead, because he can save you. And so it is with the unconscious aspect. You're the conscious, and sometimes you have to let the unconscious have its trip, because it may save you. And anyway,
What did he think of the acid trip? Do you remember him saying anything after?
Well, I mean, that's all demonstrated by his making the album.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember what he said. We all were saying it. He loved it. He just went with it right straight through. Oh yeah, he was. Anyway.
Okay, let me read what Bob says about that, this meeting. Here's his description. Let's see. That Sunday afternoon, both Connie and I showed up at her apartment on Knob Hill. That's Grace's apartment.
Yeah,
they're going to... Okay, Alan Watts was one of my heroes, someone who dared to break the rules of conventional thinking, stepping out of the mud of this rotting society that stifled any attempt to be truly creative and free. I guess somebody... Anyway, he goes, yes, let's go and meet this Grace, or whatever she calls herself. Okay, that's in response to you calling. Right. This is you.
Well, that must be a slipshod way of placing themselves. Undoubtedly, they had a meeting like that, but their very first meeting with Mildred Grace was when I took her over to Bob Filmon's house, and we had that nice, happy day.
But no acid,
nothing.
Well, when was the acid session then? No, that's just you and Grace. Right, okay. Then Grace arranges for Bob and Connie to come over to Grace's place.
Yes.
But you're thinking it's in Connie's place? No, okay. It's in Grace's place where the LSD happened, right?
No. It was in Filmon's place that the LSD happened.
Oh, okay.
Now, after they met Grace, and she talked about Alan Watts, it's possible that they may have visited her apartment at that time on Knob Hill to set up the thing, which I didn't know about. I just know that she wanted them to meet, and the way they met was as I have described.
So here's how he describes it. He says, that Sunday afternoon, both Connie and I showed up at her apartment on Knob Hill. It was one of those little places on the side of a hill with steps that led up to the apartment. Grace was nice looking, but a little reserved. So that would be what Alan Watts said about her, right? You know, she did not enjoy life, or didn't enjoy life. She's reserved, I guess. She was from the East Coast. She had taught school, but was now looking for something different to do with her life. And now he's talking about, you know, your girlfriend, but he may not knew that. He didn't know that.
Yes. There's lots of things that you don't know in there because they're just simply left out.
Right.
Or transliterated, which, of course, is the writer's prerogative. But anyway...
Let me continue. He says, I decided to call her Grace. The name seemed to fit her. She had been attending Alan Watts' seminars, and she was seeing him and hoping that there would be something more for her than just being one of his many girlfriends. Does that seem familiar to you?
Well, I don't know.
Because he was more with you.
Well, the point is, she'd known Watts for a couple of years when she met me.
Right.
So I have no idea.
Okay.
I know that she'd been divorced a couple of times and was so upset about that. And see, she was a psychologist for the Jewish Family Service, it's one of those NGOs, nonprofit organization anyway. And
not B'nai B'rith.
No, this was just the Jewish Family Service is what it was called, which
okay.
is like any office that would be helping families, but this happened to be Jewish Family, and she was a psychologist with that.
So Bob Carr says, after a couple of hours of talking about this and that, we said, quote, it's nice to meet you, but we have to go back to Oakland. And she says it would be nice to see you again. She asked for a phone number, so we exchanged numbers. She was looking for intellectual answers, ideas she could compare and think over, mull over, and systematize. Is that what you thought Grace would be doing?
Well, the meeting happened with her at Philman's. They may have had this additional meeting afterwards before the other. It's
before
quite possible it's in there. So it's like... which came first, the chicken or the egg, in terms of thoughts? I mean, the actuality is it started at Philman's house. Then,
but is she someone who's looking for intellectual answers from your perspective? Is she that kind of person?
Well, I don't know. I think she wasn't as preoccupied with the intellectual because she'd gone into that pretty far because she was in Subud. And of course, if she was, she may have started looking intellectually with Watts.
Right.
And Watts undoubtedly had an effect on her.
Okay.
And she probably was relatively reserved, because if she was working as a psychologist in Jewish Family Service, that would be likely. But around me, she was a kind of a mellow and smiley and, stuff. It wasn't that reserved.
Where were you living, and was she living with you?
No, she wasn't living with me. It was, let's see, where was I living? I'm trying to think. That may have been a time when I lived on Knob Hill, too.
Oh, okay.
So, no, that was in 1960. No, not yet. No, I was living right downtown... San Francisco. Well, I chose a place that was not far from where I worked at the Emporium. Turned out to be at the Tenderloin.
Yeah.
But we were surrounded by all kinds of our favorite bars, so that was handy, too.
And okay. Now, you're talking about we...
I'm talking about Chris and Vern and I.
Vern and you. Now, what's the Emporium? Is that the rare coin thing you were doing?
Well, that's where I first started working in rare coins. The Emporium is a huge department store, system of department stores.
It's a chain.
Yeah, but their original one was right downtown San Francisco.
What is Vern doing at that time?
I don't know whether it was right then or later. He was working as a surgical technician in a hospital.
Okay. So she writes, Bob Carr writes, Grace called after a few days and asked if we would like to meet Alan. She told him she had met some Far Out guys and went on to describe us to him. Now, that would fit in with what she said.
Yep.
You said, that she felt joyful around you, so she
yep.
tells these guys, tells Alan Watts. Bob Carr says, why don't you invite him over for dinner? She said she would call him and get back to us. Connie had been fixing up Bob's house. You remember that? And we had built a Japanese waterfall and pool in the entranceway just inside the house. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the whole house had been transformed into a psychedelic palace.
Mm-hmm.
This was going to be fun, I thought, and planned to cook a Japanese banquet. Alan and Grace arrived. Now, he's leaving out the fact that you were there. in this situation.
And he's leaving out the fact that Noyes.
Yeah.
And
Anton.
Yeah, and let's see.
Was Sandy Jacobs there, the guy who recorded?
I don't think he was.
Okay.
That was a later connection as far as I knew. I don't know, maybe they had it already, but it, I don't think so.
Okay.
But I think Watts knew Jacobs. Maybe that's what connected them. Well, actually, didn't he do Watts' record?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Yeah, he did the record, Sandy Jacobs.
Yeah, but that was later.
Okay. Alan and Grace arrived. Alan was just what I had thought he would be like, not serious, stuffy, or intellectual at all. He had a twinkle in his eyes, and I'm sure he noticed that we were not straight either. It was an evening of enjoying good food, wine, and faro conversations about everything. There were no boundaries or directions. We all had a marvelous time. But the highlight of the evening was when Connie introduced Biff. It's a real shock when a well-mannered chimp joins in on the fun. Alan couldn't believe his eyes, and Grace was just amazed at the whole scene. It was more than she could imagine.
This is before we took acid?
He doesn't bring up the acid, so he's mixing in the acid meeting with maybe the first meeting at his home that you recall, when Grace was crying. You know, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Alan couldn't believe his eyes, and Grace was just amazed at the whole scene. It was more than she could imagine. It was quite late when the party ended. After we finished lying on the floor and listening to Wagner on the new state-of-the-art stereo system that Connie had built.
Yes.
Did that happen during the acid night, listening to Wagner?
I'm sure we had all kinds of incredible albums. Because you have to remember, we had had albums, stereo albums, before anybody in the world had them.
Right.
You know, there were 50 that had been recorded, but about a year later, 10 of them went out when the first stereos were released, and so they had to have stereos. So we had all 10 of them already as a part of the acid sessions for a year. And now let's see, what am I...
So there was stereo when you were doing acid the night before?
Yeah, they were made by the they were made by the guys that I referred to, you know, Elliot Craig and
Dan Collins. Yeah,
they had the shop or something. They made up something for us, and we consequently almost everybody who had sessions with us wanted a set. So they were selling all kinds of stereo sets to people who had been in the sessions, and there was like 75 people over 3 years, that, as far as I recall, that I don't have an accurate counting, but that's my guesstimation that I've used for years.
And Connie could build them.
Well, by 1960.
Yeah. Okay.
He might have even been building them with the other guys in the meantime. That wasn't a part of my picture.
Okay. So he says, Alan Watts came across as very direct, with no phony, I am the guru airs. He was a bit English, reserved, but that was his background. There was some sadness in his eyes. I felt that he was a prisoner caught in a world that denied the simple pleasures of the body and tried to make us feel guilty about just being human.
Well, the fact of the matter was that Watts was an Anglican priest who married a very rich, excuse me if I say snotty, woman. And when he started branching off and talking in the church about different religion, of Buddhism and Zen, the church... I don't know whether they kicked him out, but they made it necessary for him to leave, and his wife was furious. But because he had written some bestseller books, like about Zen, I think there was one that was something kind of Zen and Zen, Zen and Zen. You know,
yeah,
you can find those, and that supplied good, and then he was lecturing and receiving some funds, so it didn't matter too much. But at a certain point, when it slowed down and she got more bitter, then she divorced him. And because his income had been fairly high, the alimony, I mean, of course, she took half of everything they had, and then the alimony was set very high. And so I know he felt compelled to write and to lecture in order to get enough money for her alimony.
Mm.
And it was a long time before he married Mary Jane because of it, but Mary Jane says, it doesn't matter, go ahead. And she helped him in raising the alimony money for the ex-wife. And so I'm sure if you look at the sadness, it's there because ultimately one of the sorrows of my life was when I found out, see, this is a guy who had access to all kinds of drugs and so on, ultimately. But he wouldn't commit suicide with the poison. But he did go out and stay in a cabin and just simply drank himself to death without eating. That's what the story I heard. And it was like his way of fairly comfortably committing suicide.
Right, that's Alan Watson. He dies in 73, I think.
I don't know specifically.
Well, I can look it up on Google, but the thing is, that so that's your take on the sadness in his eyes by 1960. Did he bring the British woman to New England?
No. I never saw her. She was just like a phantom in the background I heard about.
Yeah, you don't know, because I know he came to the States, you know, in the early 50s or something, or late 40s, and you don't know if that...
I don't know when they divorced. I think he was in the States and he was preaching and then ultimately started talking about other religions, and the Anglicans threw him out, and his wife stayed with him as long as she got the money. And then when she apparently was from a rich family, so she didn't really need the money, but it was a way to get even with him constantly. So that it's that kind of a consciousness that he was having to deal with.
Right. Okay.
You know, it happens to some great men, you know.
Yeah. It says here in a section on Wikipedia, London afforded him a considerable number of opportunities for personal growth. Through Humphreys, he contacted eminent spiritual authors like Nicholas Roerich, Sarvapalli Radhakrishnan, and prominent theosophists like Alice Bailey. In 1936, age 21, he founded the World Congress of Faith at the University of London, heard D.T. Suzuki read a paper, and afterwards was able to meet this esteemed scholar of Zen Buddhism. Beyond these discussions and personal encounters, he absorbed by studying...
And what year?
This would be in the 30s.
Oh, my Lord.
Beyond these discussions and personal encounters, he absorbed by studying the available scholarly literature, the fundamental concepts and terminology of the main philosophies of India and East Asia. In 1936, Watts' first book was published, The Spirit of Zen, which he later acknowledged to be mainly digested from the writings of Suzuki. And so that would be, he'd be 21, 22 years old. He was born in 1915. He did die in 1973, but to carry on, it says, in 1938, he and his bride left England to live in America. He had married Eleanor Everett. Everett, that's where you live right now. Whose mother, Ruth Fuller Everett, was involved with a traditional Zen Buddhist circle in New York. A few years later, Ruth Fuller married the Zen master Sokien Sasaki, and this Japanese gentleman served as a sort of model and mentor to Alan Watts, though Watts chose not to enter into a formal Zen training relationship with Sasaki. During these years, according to his later writings, Watts had another mystical experience while on a walk with his wife. It says, Watts had left formal Zen training in New York because the method of the teacher didn't suit him. He was not ordained as a Zen monk, but he felt a need to find a professional outlet for his philosophical inclinations. He entered an Anglican school in Evanston, Illinois, where he studied Christian scripture, theology, and church history.
So that's when he entered the Anglican school. I thought he was in England in Anglican.
Right.
No. So he was Zenny before he even went Anglican.
Yeah. If this is accurate. And it says, he attempted to work out a blend of contemporary Christian worship, mystical Christianity, and Asian philosophy. Watts was awarded a master's degree in theology in response to his thesis, which he published as a popular edition under the title Behold the Spirit. The pattern was set in that Watts did not hide his dislike for religious outlooks that he decided were dour, guilt-ridden, or militantly proselytizing, whether found within Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, or Buddhism. All seemed to go reasonably well in his next role as Episcopalian priest, beginning in 1945, age 30, until an extramarital affair resulted in his young wife having their marriage annulled. It also resulted in Watts leaving the ministry by 1945.
No, she had it annulled.
Yeah. Because he had an affair. So it resulted in Watts.
What about the divorce? No divorce?
I don't know. Nothing more, I guess. Anyways, he leaves the ministry in 1950, and I know he's doing his radio talks in 50, 51, 52 with Gerd Stern, who we do long interviews with.
Yes.
Gerd Stern was the program director or some engineer or something with Watts at KPFA in Berkeley at that time.
Yes.
Watts spent the new year getting to know Joseph Campbell, his wife Jean Erdman, and John Cage.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In the spring of 1951, Watts moved to California. So that'll be when, I guess, Gerd gets...
Without wife?
Yeah. It says where he joined the faculty of the American Academy of Asian Studies in San Francisco. Because he's not a minister anymore. Here he taught alongside Saburo Hasegawa, Frederick Spiegelberg, Haridas Choudhury, Lama Takwan Tada, and various visiting experts and professors. Hasegawa, in particular, served as a teacher to Watts in the areas of Japanese customs, arts, primitivism, and perceptions of nature. Watts also studied written Chinese and practiced Chinese brush calligraphy with Hasegawa, as well as with some of the Chinese students who enrolled at the academy. While Watts was noted for an interest in Zen Buddhism, with its origins in China, his reading and discussions delved into Vedanta, the new physics, you know, like quantum physics, cybernetics, semantics, process philosophy, natural history, and the anthropology of sexuality.